720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us this lovely, finally, springtime Saturday. It is great weather out there, and I hope you get to enjoy some of it today for sure. Lots to do on the Business Lunch today. We're going to kick things off talking a lot about retail. There's a lot of conversation going on about retail, particularly physical locations of stores and how they're adapting or not adapting so well in this environment in which most people are shopping online. So we'll be talking about that a little bit later in the show. We're going to be talking about how that gig economy has expanded into yet another area, one that you might not think about where fitting very well, but nonetheless, here we are. So joining us to start this conversation about retail is Abba Bhattarai, who is a business reporter for Washington Post. Abba, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us and taking time out of your Saturday. I certainly appreciate that. You have written recently at the Washington Post, and everybody head to WashingtonPost.com and be sure and catch this piece that she wrote about Macy's in particular, because Macy's, here's a 160-year-old brand, a very iconic retail brand here in the U.S., and they've really hit some very, very hard times, but there's really a lot of factors, and you've examined those for us in this piece. But tell us roughly, you know, where do we even begin in this conversation about Macy's?
Yeah, so Macy's is part of a bigger trend here of gloom and doom for a lot of longtime American retailers. And there are a number of factors going into this, but for Macy's in particular, it's the demise of the shopping mall. Macy's for so long has been, you know, the anchor of the shopping mall. You maybe stop at Macy's and then go to all the surrounding stores, and now all of those are dying off and people just aren't getting into their cars and going to the malls anymore. The other thing is that Macy's has lost its luster over the last few decades. It doesn't really deliver anything special. There's nothing you can get at Macy's that you can't get anywhere else, probably cheaper or easier. And so it's losing a lot of traffic to places like TJ Maxx, Nordstrom Rack, even Target and Walmart.
And, you know, as you talk about in the piece, there were, you know, those factors and other things. But to me, this points at kind of a bigger cultural shift, because it seems their biggest, you know, pain point, not the biggest, but a big pain point anyway, is that competition from discount places like TJ Maxx and Marshalls and Ross and things like that. And so they've even gone so far as making and at least experimenting with their own version of that called Backstage. And some of those are in the locations. But to me, that's a bigger piece, I think, than just the fact that there's a better deal out there, but more of a, that the consumer has changed.
Exactly. The consumer has absolutely changed. And if they know exactly what they want, they're more likely to buy that sort of item online on Amazon or Walmart, where it'll arrive in a few days and they don't have to worry about it. But if it's something where they kind of want a more luxury experience, or where they want to feel like they're digging for the hunt, they're either likely to go to a higher end department store like the Neiman Marcus's of the world, or they're likely to go to a TJ Maxx or a Marshall's, where, you know, they get the thrill of the hunt and they feel like they got a great deal coming out of the store.
So it's almost that it's middlehood is really what's hurting it too here, because it's not Neiman Marcus, it's not on that level, but it's not competitive with a TJ Maxx or Marshall's.
Exactly, and that's what we're seeing across the board. Kohl's, JCPenney, Sears, these are all sort of the middle-of-the-road department stores that are really struggling right now.
Right, but it seems, and you point this out in the piece, this term, the race to the bottom, because retails, I mean, we've seen this with so many industries, right? When the consumer behavior changes, it does feel like a race to the bottom until someone does something drastically different to really change that industry to meet customer behavior and meet customers kind of where they are, as opposed to trying to keep, keep reducing or keep trying small things to kind of stem the bleeding, as it were.
Exactly. And the race to the bottom for retail in particular has been in discounting. We've seen this in so many different examples in the last several years, where, you know, you just don't feel like buying anything unless it's 40%, 50%, 60% off. And customers have really been trained to look for that. And Macy's, I mean, that's been their biggest strategy. And it's had to be their strategy, because that's the easiest way to get customers in their stores to buy something. But eventually that ends up eating away at their profit margins. And it ends up, just as you said, being a race to the bottom. And that's what we're seeing here.
Yeah. And then there's the real estate piece of this, because there's the very iconic Macy's right there in New York at Herald Square, that it seems like that's another move. A lot of times when you see a struggling industry, they start looking at, okay, where else can we get cash flow going? And that's, and so they're starting to look at some real estate options.
Exactly. And this is where Macy's really has a leg up. They own billions of dollars worth of real estate. That store in Herald Square, which takes up an entire block in Manhattan, is worth a few billion dollars. And so if they really wanted to, that's where they could start recouping some cash. They've also started in certain places in Brooklyn and Seattle, renting out or selling the top floors of their stores and converting those into office spaces to get extra income that way. So they are trying here and there, and they're making some changes to their stores as well, adding furniture and mattresses, moving into fine jewelry, to see if they can spend the bleeding, as you said.
Right, right. Well, but again, it seems like just kind of a temporary fix. A lot of them kind of seem like a Band-Aid sort of solution. Even selling very large pieces of real estate, that's just a cash infusion. But still, at some point, they're going to have to, all the retailers, not just Macy's, they're going to have to figure out a way to meet customer behavior. And do you see any of the big retailers doing that in a way that, that seems innovative or that customers seem to respond to, just kind of off the top of your head?
The most innovation that we've seen seems to be coming from, you know, the usual players, Amazon. They're experimenting with custom fit clothing that would be delivered to you very quickly. They've added their own private label brands that will get to you in 2 days if you have Amazon Prime. And so they're really going after the fashion market in a big way. And I think that's where we're going to start to see some headwinds.
Right. I think that that would be an interesting shift for consumers for sure, because I can't, I don't know, something about ordering something custom fit, because, you know, we're all fussy. We all have some kind of fit we don't like, and we want to try things on, and it's a pain to return. And, you know, so I think that will be an interesting place. The person that solves for that will probably be the retailer that wins for a little while anyway. Well, all very interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, all very interesting. And I always think it's very interesting to watch industries shift, and we appreciate your analysis and perspective. Thank you so much for being with us, Abba Boteri. Thanks so much. We will talk to you again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. All right, we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back here in just a bit. And we're going to keep this conversation rolling about retail, because as we've been talking about with Abba about retailers that are struggling to meet customer needs and really rise to that shifting customer behavior, there is one particular sector that has physical locations that is really thriving. In fact, they're growing. So we're going to talk about that when we come back on 720 WGN. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Lots to do, as ever, on this lovely day. Lots of people outside of Michigan Avenue enjoying the sunshine. I hope you are able to do some of the same, because it is darn lovely out there today. Well, we have been talking about the retail industry in the first half of the show. A little bit later in the show, we're going to be looking at the gig economy and how it is touching another sector of business that perhaps we have not thought yet, when we think about the gig economy and all this. It's touching all the realms indeed, but lots to do still this first half of the show. We were talking a little bit about Macy's just before the break, about how they have struggled and how they're looking at other options to adapt to consumer behavior, where we all want a deal and we're all getting better and better at finding them online, and we want it now and we want it shipped to our house without shipping costs and all that stuff, and how physical retailers are really struggling in that environment. But there's one sector in particular in retail that is not suffering and is not struggling, and in fact is growing a little bit. So joining us to talk about that is Laura Holson, who's a feature writer at New York Times. Welcome to the program, Laura.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thank you so much for taking time out of your Saturday to be with us.
Well, I was a little bit jealous when you were talking about how great the weather was, because it is raining here.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was us earlier in the week. So it's coming. I promise. We're sending it your way.
Excellent.
Good. So you have written this piece for New York Times that is very, very interesting, because we were just talking about how brick and mortar physical locations of retailers have really, really struggled. They're even looking to sell off some of their iconic real estate. But then we look to the cosmetics industry, and here's an area in which we don't see that. In fact, we're seeing growth in retail. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, there's definitely growth. I think one thing with services like Instagram, places like Sephora, where they allow you to kind of play and learn on Instagram, of course, you're kind of watching people looking at videos and stuff, that customers are more, you know, educated about makeup. And so when you're more educated about something, you tend to buy more. They've been, you know, Sephora and Ulta are, you know, the number one and two retailers in the world for cosmetics. And I think it's because they've really catered to millennials and young people who are, you know, used to kind of going out with their friends and, you know, looking at makeup, where if you go to Macy's, it can be a little bit intimidating to go to the counter when, you know, 10 people are jumping at you because, you know, they may work on commission and everybody's trying to get your sale.
Right. Well, it is a very different vibe in there, right? If you're in a department store, there is an expectation that if you look at a particular product too long, you should be buying it. There's not that.
Yeah, it's a total, you've nailed it. It's total guilt. And like, yeah. I buy cosmetics. I love them. And if I want to go get a makeover, it's almost kind of hard to go to someplace like Bergdorf's or, you know, in New York or, you know, Macy's. Or any place, because you're right. They're like looking at you, you know, kind of with ka-ching signs in their eyes, mm-hmm. like you're going to buy at least 5 products, you know, and kind of make their day. So,
right. But
that's changing, I think, as people have become more educated. And also, they're not really brand loyal anymore. So it's not like they'll walk into a store and buy, you know, the whole Estee Lauder line. They may pick something from MAC. They'll pick something up from, you know, Makeup Forever or something, you know, maybe from, you know, Estee Lauder, something from, you know, some brand that we probably didn't even know about yet, because there are a lot of new emerging brands.
Right. And you mentioned social media, Instagram in particular. And I think that and there's so many cosmetic focused bloggers and video bloggers that do so much. I mean, there's so many tutorials of how to get this look and do this and accomplish this. And, you know, there's some that will pop up that'll just try 5 new mascaras or something like that, that I think that's adding to that customer savvy.
Have you watched any of the Instagram, you know, tutorials? I'm just curious. Have you?
I've seen a couple of them. I mostly have seen people doing very complicated hairstyles.
Well, you know, I actually, for the story, I really got into it to kind of see what people were doing. And it was kind of amazing. Like, it's a production. I used to write about Hollywood, and I would talk to, you know, costume designers and, you know, makeup designers as well. And there was this really complex process to actually put on makeup for a, you know, for the screen, you know, whether it's television or for movies. And I'm telling you, the young women today, mostly young women, are doing the same thing that they would do, you know, professional, as they would do for movies and television. So there's a real industry. You should watch them. I mean, I still haven't got contouring down yet. I don't know. I still look like I have stripes on my face.
Right.
But maybe I just need to watch a little bit more.
I know. I think that the act of contouring your face is a really tricky one. There's a fine line between nailing it and really looking kind of ridiculous. So I think use caution on that one.
No, completely. But you know what I was going to say as well, as, you know, at places like Sephora, you know, and Ulta, also, you know, oh my God, Makeup Forever, which just opened a store in New York. They'll teach you classes where you can go and literally sit with 3 or 4 other people, and they'll teach you how to do a smoky eye. And I did it with my niece. You know, she and I went because I wanted to see what they, you know, how they would teach you. And it was really, really good. And it wasn't like if I would go to just dealing with one, you know, salesperson at a department store where, again, you have that guilt factor. This kind of took away a little bit of that sting of thinking I have to get all of these products for the smoky eye. Actually, I didn't. I ended up buying makeup remover, so go figure. But that was probably one sale that they wouldn't have made if I hadn't, you know, done that class.
Right, right. Well, there is something to be said for that. Having the cosmetics out, encouraging play, encouraging experimentation, I think that really sets a tone in those stores where you feel like you can just kind of go and browse and not feel like you have to go in, as you said, you don't have to be brand loyal. You don't have to walk in just to buy a particular kind of foundation. You can keep experimenting or, you know, looking for the right eyeliner or whatever. You can kind of play with them, which I think goes a long way for the consumer, for sure.
Department stores, and particularly at Macy's, because I spoke with some people from Macy's, what they're trying to do with their sales clerks is to make them more brand and agnostic, so that people don't feel like bound to one brand or one type of cosmetics. Because let's face it, maybe an eyeshadow works for you with Stila. You may like their eyeshadows, but maybe they don't work so well if you're using Tom Ford, or, Chantecaille has a really great foundation, which I like. I mean, I enjoy it. And I really can't wear anything else. So if someone is kind of trying to box me into one kind of brand, I'm just going to walk away.
Right.
It's just not going to be helpful to me.
There's a line that you wrote in this piece in the New York Times, which everyone should go check this out because it's a really interesting piece with mm-hmm. a lot of good information in it. But there's one line that really stuck out to me because I think that it is kind of the sign of the times, really, because I think that it extends far, far beyond the cosmetics industry. And the line is this: friends hold as much sway these days as trained experts. And I think of that even in terms of book recommendations and film recommendations. I mean, I think now it is because of social media, because we kind of build our tribes, we tend to listen to that group that we construct a little bit more than whether or not something's on the bestseller list or whatever the box office did.
You nailed it. I think we're in kind of a community now, whether it's on Facebook, whether it's on Twitter or Instagram, where you kind of find people who are like minds and you share information with them. And which is, I think, kind of fantastic, because it's much easier to find, your tribe, if you will, around the country, not just in your, own neighborhood. But what I think it also stems from, if you look at, young women, teenage women, for example, they tend to kind of want to do things in packs, right? Mm-hmm. So, why not go to Sephora and go in a pack? I mean, I saw young women there, and they were like having a blast. It was like, woohoo, Friday night at Sephora. One was trying something on, something else. So it was this real kind of communal experience that I think people, are looking for, given that our lives so much are more online, if you will.
Right.
So you can kind of combine the learning from online, but then apply it in your real life with your pals who are going to tell you, that pink is not good for you, or someone who may be trying. Right. Haven't we all had like an experience like that?
Sure.
You come home and you buy something and you're like, why did I buy that? And you're like, well, the woman said it looked good, and it may look good to her, but it's not really your friends think, why did you buy that? You really don't look good in gold lipstick.
Right. Right.
Well, it's not age appropriate.
Right. And it becomes this kind of, it's the sense of, playing in your big sister's makeup drawer, your mom's makeup drawer, but on such a larger scale. And I think that's kind of the appeal of that, it being a destination thing to go and do.
Yeah, if you haven't, looked at what Sephora has been great at, I should say, is technology. That I was watching, because I just sometimes go to stores and kind of watch how consumers, use these things. There was this young woman, and we wrote a little bit about her in the story as well, who was trying on false eyelashes. And she literally was looking at a mirror, and so she could see herself, but it was really a camera. And she could, swipe left, and the eyebrows would, appear on her eyes, because, again, it's like a camera. It's kind of augmented reality. And she and her pal were having the best time. I mean, I wanted to go try it, and I've never worn a false eyelash in my life
right.
because it looked like it was so much fun.
Right.
It's like, can I look like Nicki Minaj, or can I look like, Katy Perry, And I think it's that sense of play that people really, they want more of, and especially in this era where, if you look at a lot of the news, it's not all fun. And so, where people can find fun in shopping, which, seems to be the way, a lot of stores are going, I think they'll attract people. These stores will attract people who are looking for a little bit more joy than, wondering what's going to happen to the country.
Right. Definitely. For sure. Well, it's really interesting to watch this particular area of retail really adapt to consumer behavior. It's so interesting. Everybody head to New York Times, read this piece. It's really, really interesting. There's a lot of interesting data in there, too, about how big an industry this is. It is a very, very big one. Laura Holson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, and enjoy the weather. I'm jealous.
Thank you. It'll be east soon enough. We're sending it your way now. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. We're going to get you to news and take a break and all the good stuff. When we come back, we're going to be talking about another area that in particular we're going to be focusing on, and that is how the gig economy and law have come together. More on that in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN, Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with us. Hope you're able to get outside and enjoy some of that lovely weather. I'm seeing people walking by the studio. They're smiling. They're not wearing jackets. They're not bundled up. They are darn happy about it. So I hope you are able to go out there and join them at some point. Still lots to do on the show today. We're joined now by Claire Bushey, who is a reporter at Crain's Chicago. She joins us in studio. Claire, welcome back to the show. Always a pleasure to have you around.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Well, you wrote recently this very, very interesting story. We have talked a lot about the gig economy and on this program, certainly, and how that is just different areas of industry where that touches. And one that you wrote about recently that I thought was so fascinating is how that is entering the law profession, which is so interesting because we don't think about that. We think about law being you go to law school, you get a job with a very big firm, and there you go, or you go start your own firm, and that's what you do. But in fact, this is really kind of changing the way where law's working, in a sense.
Yes, there are a lot of forces that kind of led to the rise of contract attorneys, who are a group of attorneys who primarily sort through documents that are going to be used in litigation. And it started largely with the economic crash of 2008 because there were all these lawyers who were suddenly laid off, and also law firms shrunk the size of their freshman classes, as it were. So there was a flood in the market of attorneys who were looking for work. At the same time, you've had this increasing rise of electronically stored information, everything from emails to social media to video feeds, and it all needs to be sorted through if you are suing somebody.
Sure.
So the people who are doing the sorting are this whole group of contract attorneys who are sort of, middling paid and have tens of thousands of dollars of debt.
Sure, because it's not inexpensive to go to law school. It's extremely expensive. No. It is not a casual endeavor by any means. And so you come out and you have all this debt, and so mostly this is not lawyer to consumer. This is lawyer to law firm.
Yes. The people who are buying the services for these contract attorneys who work for staffing agencies are the large law firms, and in some cases, the corporate law departments. They contract out with a staffing agency. They pay them a certain amount of money for reviewing a case, and the staffing agency goes and finds the contract attorneys.
And off they go doing this work. And so this is a lot of, indeed, as you point out, the discovery phase, I'm sure, has changed so much in decades because of how much, a tweet could change the outcome of your lawsuit.
Yes, it's not looking through boxes and boxes of paper anymore. It's looking on a screen and just clicking through and coding, a tweet or a Facebook post or an email and seeing, does this respond to what the lawsuit is about or does it not?
Mm-hmm. And so how is this shifting? It's hard to unring a bell, right? I think about some of the issues we've seen surface with rideshare apps and those kind of things. And how, in particular, just a week ago, I was talking about how when in the corporate part of Uber, suddenly, a former employee wrote this blog post that went quite viral. Mm-hmm. about mistreatment and sexual harassment, and suddenly a lot of the corporate facing pieces of it started to really check themselves.
Yes.
But a lot of female drivers were going, well, hey, what about us? And so I think there's that continual conversation about the right of the worker. And so how do we see that kind of thing playing out in the law? Because since you can't unring that bell, do we think it's going to shift the law industry?
Well, I think that the legal industry has shifted. It will not go back. You are going to have this echelon of workers that are undergirding the entire structure for these large law firms, what we think of when we think of what a lawyer is and what a lawyer does.
Sure.
And that's not going to change. But what has changed is you have this you have this economic insecurity that's at the bottom of the pyramid, and all our protections as a society have been set up to protect employees. And these people are working on a project-by-project basis. That's kind of the definition of the gig economy. And so a lot of what we think of as the, you know, the basic protections that we have for workers do not apply to people who are working in the gig economy. Contract attorneys, the same as your Uber driver.
Right, right. Well, I think that part is so interesting, regardless of industry. No matter what it is, at some point, we've got to figure that out, it seems like, because it keeps coming up over and over in every industry, whether it's a dog walker, a driver, a lawyer, whatever it is. Somewhere we're going to have to shift to protect those workers for reasons you've just outlined.
Yes. I mean, it's referred to as the casualization of the workforce, and it's been going on for 15 or 20 years. And because I don't think that we are going to revert to a society that primarily employs people through the employer-employee relationship. And so therefore, you know, I think we should be looking at extending protections for workers who do not have the traditional employer-employee relationship.
Right, right. Well, I think we're going to have to as more and more people move just out of economic necessity into this format.
Well, I mean, you have to have political will in order to do that.
Well, there's that. It always comes down to that, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Well, Claire Bushey, thank you so much for being with us and talking about your work at Cranes Chicago. Everybody, head over to chicagobusiness.com and check out this story. It's really, really interesting, and there's a lot of really interesting data in there just about what the price tag on this kind of thing is and what it's looking like and how it works, and some companies that are experimenting with this. Really, really interesting stuff. Claire, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Amy.
All right, we'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. You know, tomorrow is Mother's Day. So if you just went, oh, I forgot, you better go do that. You better go take care of it. It is big business for sure. There's a lot of numbers that we just pulled together for you looking at it. It is slated to bring in $23.6 billion this year, which is $2.2 billion more than last year and nearly $10 billion more than a decade ago. $10 billion? Did I screw this up? Because I just sent my mom some flowers. Did I need to do more, Griffin?
No, I think you're good. You're part of the $10 billion. What I was wondering is, why $2.2 billion more than last year?
Yeah, why did it go up?
Why do we like our moms so much more this year?
We were kind of on weird footing with our moms last year, but this year we're good.
And,
I don't know.
And $10 billion ago, who knows what was going on back then?
Right.
But no, I think you're good. I think if you got the flowers.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe one other, maybe and a card.
It came with the flowers. It's a note.
There's some number in there. How much of that is jewelry?
See, I would never buy my mom jewelry because, A, she would never wear it. And we have such different tastes. Like, I don't know that I could pick something out for
it's
her
kind of
she'd
dangerous.
Like.
Yeah.
She'd be like, I hate that. I'm never wearing it. So there's that. So let's see. It is $5 billion of it that will be spent on jewelry.
Wow.
Followed by $4.2 billion on dinner or brunch.
Yeah.
Flowers. $2.6
$4 billion in brunch.
$4 billion.
Who would have thought?
That's a lot of mimosas right there. That's a lot. Yeah, $5 billion on jewelry for Mother's Day.
Yeah, it's going to be hopping at the breakfast places tomorrow for sure.
Yeah, no hangover brunch unless mom's in on that.
Well,
she might be. I don't know your life. She might be leading the charge on that. That could be for sure. But, you know, interestingly, we've been talking so much this show about physical location, brick and mortar stores versus online. And in this case, Mother's Day, the physical shopping location still kind of seems to reign supreme. About 90% of the people polled said that they would shop at a physical store in some capacity for the Mother's Day stuff they had.
Huh.
Of them, yeah. Only 24% said that they would shop locally. Tisk, tisk to the rest, because that's a big deal.
What are you going to do? I imagine I'll be doing my Mother's Day shopping in an actual store. It's kind of too late to go the online route.
You don't have a choice. That's why. That's why Mother's Day shopping reigns supreme for the for the physical location reigns supreme.
Because it's all on Saturday, the Saturday before.
It's procrastination. And you're like, even Amazon Prime can't save me now. See, I knew I was going
to have... They might beg to differ on that, but yeah.
See, last year I really screwed up and ended up paying a lot in delivery because I waited too long to get the flowers to my mom. And she lives out of state, so there's no go-to-a-store option for me. So I was like, okay, this year I cannot pay more for shipping or delivery than I do for the flowers. I got to get this right. So I said it like a week ago, knowing I would be really busy this week. I was like...
Well, good on you.
And she, but then she got them like Thursday.
I bet that's like half of that billion, half of that 23 billion or however big that number is just shipping because everybody's doing it right now.
Oh, that's interesting.
I don't
know.
Could
be. That could be. A lot of people
say,
Amazon, how much do I need to pay you to get this to be at my mom's door tomorrow?
Well, if you want, Amazon is now in the brick and mortar game.
Yeah.
Though,
and you said Chicago. You saw, I haven't been up there to see it, but you've been there.
I know. I think it's been open for like a month now in Lakeview on Southport, not far from the Music Box Theater, which is where I was going, and walked by the Amazon Prime store. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess this has been on the way for a while. And it's been open for, about a month or maybe a month and a half, but I hadn't seen it until now. And I was like, whoa, this is kind of weird.
So what's in it? Is it just the basic stuff that people mostly order from Amazon, I wonder?
I think it looked like a bookstore. I didn't actually go in. I'm not the best person to report on it, I guess.
Sure.
But I didn't go in. But it looked like a Borders or Barnes & Noble.
Now, wouldn't that be the weirdest of weird if, here we go, all the, so many physical location bookstores, particularly large chain bookstores, were hit so hard by Amazon purchases, and then... Wouldn't that be irony of ironies if the bookstore came back as a result of Amazon making a store of it?
I know, yeah. And it is like so counterintuitive to see that on the marquee, not marquee, but whatever,
sure.
See that at the top of the doors. And people are not crazy about the idea either. I know that I just saw an op-ed from when this was announced earlier this year in January, I think, in the Tribune that was like, don't go there. Very strict rules from the Tribune writer there. And I don't know. I understand that side of it, but it looked kind of nice.
I don't know. I mean,
everybody was smiling.
I really try to go to local bookstores. Chicago has such a wonderful literary community here. There's so many wonderful bookstores. There's so many writers here. There's so much writing that Chicago has inspired. There's so many live lit events that I want to feed that community. I don't want to starve and punish it. So I try as much as I can to shop at like 57th Street or Women and Children First is a great bookstore up in Andersonville.
I live one by Unabridged.
Unabridged is a great, that's
very
a great
nice
bookstore.
Yeah.
Also, The Bookseller up in Lincoln Square, that is one of my favorites. They do a ton of events. They also serve wine if that is a priority to your book buying
and
needs.
Printer's Row is just coming up, right? So it's like a whole community thing that you can't get from Amazon. It's just prices versus that feeling.
Right. And like Quimby's, that's such a great bookstore.
It's kind of the age-old debate. But
I know. And it is. And it's convenience is what made it happen. And so that's why Amazon, having capsized large book retailers with its convenience, then coming in and making a bookstore just seems like the weirdest thing in the world to me.
Yeah, it's like insult to injury. It's like, oh, by the way, we can do what you did too.
Right.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's kicking them while they're down.
It's kind of cruel.
It's very
and
cruel.
And I don't know. I don't know why they think that they'll have a better crack at it. I think just their funds are, they have more money to
play with. Yeah.
And like money coming from other places besides that store. It doesn't have to be as successful as Barnes & Noble or Borders obviously needed it to be. So I don't know. We'll see.
Well, they can afford to experiment and see what's what. But it's really interesting. So we've had a lot of different points of discussion today all about changing consumer behavior, really, and how that manifests in our world. So everybody, have a great week. Do your thing. We're going to take a break, get you to news, all that good stuff, and turn you over to the Startup Showcase with Scott Catoon here in just a bit on 720 WGN.